You're listening to the OMFIF podcast, the show that explores the latest insights and discussions on global finance, economics, and policy for people who love staying informed about the rapidly evolving landscape of the financial world. Join us as we break down complex topics, interview key thought leaders, and provide essential insights to keep you informed about the evolving world of finance.
This is Mark Sobel, U.S. Chair OMFIF. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Saleha Mohsen, Senior Washington Correspondent for Bloomberg News, covering policy, politics, and power in Washington, D.C. Saleha formerly covered the U.S. Treasury Department for Bloomberg and has just written a great book based on that experience, Paper Soldiers, How the Weaponization of the Dollar Changed the World Order. Welcome, Saleha.
Hi, I'm so excited to be here, Mark.
Well, we'll see if you have that same reaction when we're through. So let's start. Easy, obvious question. Why did you write this book?
Well, Mark, I've been interested in the government's role in currency policy since I was a reporter in Oslo, Norway, where they have the world's largest sovereign wealth fund, and the way they use the profits of those funds to support its economy had a huge impact on the kroner and the, I don't know how else to say it, but the hotness of the economy, because they were always worried about heating it up too much with too much money. It's a great problem to have. And then I came to Washington, to the Treasury beat in 2016, and to get my feet wet, I started visiting with as many current and former Treasury officials as I could sort of dig up. And the dollar policy, Rubin's mantra, always came up in conversation. And a lot of people would tell me about it. Oh, you know, you should know the policy, you should know the mantra. And I would read a lot of articles about it. But in the autobiographies of the secretaries, Treasury secretaries from Rubin onwards, it wasn't really mentioned much, a couple of lines, even in Rubin's autobiography. Maybe there's a page and a half dedicated to the dollar. I read the chapters related to economic policy in all the presidential autobiographies of the era, and in the same thing, wouldn't come up a lot. And so I just felt like, here's this kabuki game. There's a subject that no one wants to talk about it. I'm a reporter, so let me just keep talking about it and keep asking about it. The other reason was that there's a lot of Fed books out there, a lot of books on the Federal Reserves, and there's nothing just on Treasury. We've got secretaries' biographies. We've got a couple of great books on just on economic sanctions, but nothing on the whole building. So I decided, all right, let's give this a try.
Well, thank you. So you just alluded to it. You write a great deal about the strong dollar mantra, which Secretary Rubin kicked off in the second half of the 90s. And then it went through a lot of ups and downs under subsequent Treasury secretaries. Can you discuss that for us?
Yeah, it was really cool to report on this for the book. I was able to get inside the rooms where dollar discussions happened through people's living memories, including where, you know, the room where the mantra was created. Roger Altman, Bob Rubin, sometimes Tim Geithner, Larry Summers, all piled into a room at the White House discussing economic policy and how it relates to government currency policy. And then I just dissected exactly how we got to the point where it is a mantra. So there was this 1-2 punch that I heard about, that Larry Summers, who at the time was the Undersecretary of International Affairs, and Alan Greenspan, the Federal Reserve Chair, did this 1-2 punch when they both had hearings the same week in July in the mid-90s in Congress. And so they decided they were going to do these, deliver these comments about the dollar. And then a couple of weeks later, Bill Clinton was traveling in Italy. I think it was a G7, and he mentioned the dollar. And I was able to piece together how this mantra came together that led to Bob Rubin at his confirmation hearing before senators, sort of the first time he stated it as an incoming secretary. And from there, it was really interesting to sort of live through its evolution in real time, not constantly thinking about knowing what's happened since then. But then we get to Paul O'Neill. And I read in newspaper articles of the day that everyone, traders and investors, and of course, financial journalists were wondering, well, is the strong dollar mantra that has truly brought some calm to currency trading and the relationship between traders and U.S. government economic policymakers brought calm to them. Is that going to continue in not only a Republican administration, but also under Paul O'Neill, the Treasury Secretary designate, who was coming from industry? He came from aluminum markets, where a weak dollar would be a good thing for American exporters and American manufacturers. And so watching how that evolution happened was interesting. And then I trace in the book the media spectacle. It got really, really bad with O'Neill, particularly, and Jon Snow, who came after him. When I read somewhere, I think it was a Bloomberg article from that time, that Jon Snow, when he became secretary, he was traveling in, I think, Missouri, and had visited a Build-A-Bear factory. And he's holding those little house containers that a Build-A-Bear comes in, and he had bought it for his granddaughter. And he's asked by a reporter about the dollar. And I just thought, what a wild thing that has happened in our country's economic history, this tiny little moment that I wanted to highlight. And from there, you get to Hank Paulson, where the policy and the mantra, kind of the discussion of it, went quiet. So I spent a bit of time asking people why that was. And it seemed like there was a link to Paulson's gravitas that he was bringing, a return to a secretary who came from Wall Street, the investor community. In fact, he was Wall Street royalty, coming from Goldman. And then I trace it to, 2008, when you would think an American-made global financial crisis would make people run away from the US dollar, but they actually ran toward it as a safe haven. And then, we get through Jack Lew, and then Stephen, or, Geithner and Jack Lew, I kind of lump into the post-financial crisis era of the dollar. And it really did kind of go dormant. I remember writing a story in 2016 as a, I had just started covering Treasury, and I was learning about the strong dollar policy. And I just wrote a story about how this thing is dormant. No one cares anymore. And then lo and behold, Steven Mnuchin, under the Trump era, starts, and it becomes a thing. We have a Treasury Secretary for the first time in almost a quarter of a century, not afraid necessarily to opine about a weaker dollar and its benefits. And then that gets carried over into the Biden administration, when Janet Yellen does not restore Treasury's currency policy to the Rubin era one, even though, Larry Summers openly called for it, saying whoever Biden's first Treasury Secretary is, this norm should be reinstalled. And she didn't. And I found it interesting and revealing about where U.S. economic policy was heading if someone like Yellen was also not willing to bring its return.
Well, thanks. I mean, of course, Yellen has not really spoken about the dollar and just avoided it. But let me be in that vein a bit provocative. I mean, what did a strong dollar mean other than a Potemkin Village mantra to shield the secretary from often talking about currencies and the associated possible market disruptions? So, I mean, as you know, I found constant journalistic questioning about the strong dollar to be a bit of an annoying, cute gotcha game. It seemed to me that many simply wanted to get an exciting headline. I think, as your book points out, a secretary surely can't engage in substantive dialogue about currencies without causing volatility. And then the media, you knew we weren't going to intervene. And the Fed, of course, is in charge of monetary policy, even if Treasury is responsible in principle for exchange rate policy. So what's your reaction to that?
I think all of the above is accurate and then some. It did really become this wild game. You had, like I said, Jon Snow standing with bears for his granddaughter. And also, I lay out in the book, I broke down this one scene in Deauville in France, where Jon Snow, a PhD in economics, who had this professorial-like quality to him, and when he tried to have just an open conversation with reporters about the dollar to say, hey, this is not a big deal, it backfired on him. I think that it's both. It definitely got out of hand. But if you move the clock backwards to the 80s, the reason I have one chapter that's called Control Freaks and Vigilantes, the control freaks are government economic policymakers who were actually intervening in currency markets in the 80s. So that's where it started. You would hear stories about when Jim Baker was Treasury Secretary under Reagan, if he didn't like where the dollar was at, he would pick up the phone from his office and call a Reuters journalist and make some comments on background. And so all of a sudden, you know, traders couldn't necessarily trust where markets, the laws of supply and demand and what they were revealing about the foreign exchange rate, because secretaries were involved. I mean, you had two secret meetings in the 80s, one at the Plaza Hotel. So that's the Plaza Accord, where finance ministers from the G5 snuck into the hotel, and most of Reagan's cabinet didn't even know about that meeting. Afterward, I think it was the Secretary of State at the time who was angry, saying, "I didn't even know this was going to happen." And they intervene in the currency. They wanted to control it somewhat. And then the Louvre. And, you know, Rubin brought in the mantra, created it to bring calm and to untangle some of that tension. And to a large extent, it worked. Things did calm down. But I think since then, we've seen examples of how once markets believe there's no manipulation, you're just not going to do it because you've said it. There's the temptation from the policymaker side could become pretty strong. I think about how I think it was early 1997, Rubin did want to tinker with the dollar. He did say that, you know, he switched around the wording of how he delivered his statement to say, "We have had a strong dollar for some time now." And in his book, he actually does say, "Yes, I added those words, for some time now, by design." So it was kind of this scenario where policymakers had told traders to watch the words carefully. Geithner, when I interviewed him for the book, he said to me that we talked about what it meant. And he said, you know, it was a policy, the strong dollar policy was designed to be a policy of all seasons. It's not a statement of what the exchange rate should be by design. And he said that another virtue of the framing as it was created under Rubin was to make it harder for successors to abandon the policy. So it seems like, according to Geithner, there was some intention behind making it so that you should ask the question because it might reveal where economic policy is headed. And the one example that's outside the US that kind of comes to me is I was in a Bloomberg newsroom in 2015 when the Swiss National Bank's Thomas Jordan abandoned the Swiss franc peg. And he took advantage of being able to shock markets, because I think just weeks before he had said there is no plan to abandon the peg. And so the surprises have been there. And that's what makes traders and then journalists want to come back and find out, is there anything else here that we need to be aware of? And then it just starts this vortex where no one can get out of this cat and mouse cage.
Well, thanks for that. A lot of thoughts in there. You know, I think the 80s was a different era, given the soaring dollar. I attribute that to the back of the U.S. monetary fiscal mix. Thank you for your references to Secretary Snow. He was one of the very smart man, very thoughtful, kind, and whatnot. And I liked your comments on Tim Geithner. You could say that strong dollar meant a directional, you know, the dollar should go up. You could say it meant a, you know, the dollar should be firm, kind of a level remark, or you could say it really was about the underlying fundamentals of the economy should remain strong. But in any case, anytime you opened your mouth, it could create a lot of confusion. So always better to have a mantra, a Potemkin Village mantra, as I call it. Great. Your book title asserts how the weaponization of the dollar changed the world order. You write nicely about how Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control evolved since 9/11, as did the buildup in the terrorist finance and intelligence part of the Treasury. I'd like to hear about this and weaponization of the dollar.
Yeah, this was a narrative arc that kind of emerged. You know, I had written the first draft of the book and then kind of come out of book leave. And in February of 2022, and all of a sudden we all saw US-led sanctions on Russia emerge. And then it just felt like the ultimate weaponization. And so I remember thinking, okay, as terrible as this moment is, it's given me the arc for my book. This is the beginning and ending and through which I frame the story that I'm trying to tell. I spent a lot of time on each of the units. I think as a reporter covering the building, I have a unique view of Treasury. And this is something that an official under Jack Lew told me when I first kind of arrived in Washington. He said, I think it was Antonio Weiss who said that domestic finance, international affairs, TFI, they're kind of siloed and everyone has slightly different lingo sometimes for the same thing. We don't always talk to each other. But you, Saleha, and reporters like you talk to officials from all of the units and can kind of see everything in a little bit of a different perspective. And that's what I got to do here. So the story of the dollar's weaponization and how Treasury kind of gains this power or realizes and really starts to assert it starts with 9/11, when the Twin Towers were knocked down and W. Bush wanted to start his war on terror. I think it's easy to forget that war on terror did not begin with a military tank rolling into a foreign country or, U.S. troops landing somewhere. It started at the Treasury Department. George W. Bush stood with Paul O'Neill in the Rose Garden and said that with a stroke of a pen at midnight last night, I gave the Treasury Department authorities to impose economic sanctions and track financial transactions that had funded the terrorist attacks and could be funding future ones and track those money flows. And you basically, it is using the US's ownership of the world's reserve asset and the visibility that then the Treasury is allowed to track money flows to try to uncover that and stop another attack from happening. And a lot of that happened through the Office of Foreign Assets Control, the sanctions unit. And at the time, OFAC was considered a bit of an orphan of the Treasury Department. I talked to David Offhauser, who was a general counsel at Treasury in that era. And he said, the secretary in the past hadn't paid that much attention to OFAC's activities, and all of a sudden they were on deck with really complex economic sanctions. And from there, it just took off. We had in 2004, when the Department of Homeland Security was created, it pulled bits and pieces from different agencies to create DHS. And Treasury lost the Secret Service at that time. The guns and badges left the building. And instead, TFI was created, the Terrorism and Financial Intelligence Unit, and it really beefed up OFAC's role, the role of financial intelligence and tracking terrorist money flows. And then it actually gave Treasury a seat at the national security table. And as I write in the book, I got to do these mini profiles in the book, not just of Treasury secretaries whose names we all know, but of civil servants who have served for decades. In my view, stewards of the dollar, this public service. And Stuart Levy, I write about how he really helped get Treasury that seat at the national security table, because people thought, well, why is a Treasury official at this meeting? This is like intelligence community and State Department. You're just talking about money flows. And so he really had to explain and get buy-in from people around the table that, no, we have a role here. And we go from that to, in 2022, sanctions have become the go-to tool for foreign policy. And that has to do with a couple of things. One, the American electorate's appetite for actual war and kinetic action and engagement has dropped, especially since the Afghanistan withdrawal, I think, in August of 2021. And, even before that with the Iraq war and everything. And also that this space between words and war. So words would be like just diplomacy to change bad behavior. And a lot of times in history, the next step of diplomacy didn't work. Okay, let's just go to war. the US realized, and the Treasury Department realized, that there's a power in between where it's cheaper, it spills less American blood or any human blood, and it can have a big impact. And, you know, from 9/11 until now, we've seen almost 1,000% increase in the use of economic sanctions. And that, you know, through that, we've seen the fortification of certain parts of Treasury. We've seen a big rethink in, not rethink, but a lot of discussion these days about de-dollarization. Has the U.S. taken this weapon too far? And that's an active discussion, I think, in Washington and most economic and policy making circles in every capital of the world. But that's sort of where I bookended the actual weaponization in that story arc.
Okay, well, first of all, I'm absolutely shocked to hear about silos in the U.S. Treasury Department. Look, I think it makes a big difference for the dollar's global role whether the U.S. is using financial sanctions unilaterally at every turn versus in concert with our allies and with a clear strategic target, such as the 2015 Iran nuclear deal or, more recently, the blocking of Russian oligarch and central bank assets, which I totally support. I think that kind of the unilateral use could accelerate a decline in the dollar's global role, whereas the latter, using it in concert with our allies, would have a much more muted impact. What are your thoughts on this issue, which you already flagged?
I think that the dollar and our currency policy and our power that comes from ownership of this national treasure, the reserve asset, is directly linked to America's superpower status, which means that globally, there is a responsibility to lead and a responsibility to provide security and economic stability and lead into the future. And I think that America is a democracy and prides itself on being a democracy. And so then the U.S. needs to lead in globally in a democratic way as well. And so inherently, that dictates a multilateral strategy. And anytime the U.S. has gone out on a limb on its own, like you mentioned with the 2015 Iran deal, you know, withdrawing from that, there have been repercussions. And with Iran, it's a tiny thing. Not a lot of people talk about it these days. Mark, you know all about it. When Europe was trying to figure out how do we keep this Iran deal, even though the U.S. on its own tried to break it up or it withdrew themselves. And they had thought about and tried to create a special purpose vehicle where they can continue trade with Iran and not violate U.S. sanctions. And that's dangerous. All of a sudden, you have taken out some of the teeth of what American sanctions mean. And it didn't really take off, the SPV, but there is a paper trail in Europe where the efforts were discussed and there was a lot of discussion and what are the mechanics? And that means that first step has been taken. And then now with Russia sanctions, you know, the question that I get the most is, are those sanctions working? And, you know, what I like to say is that, first of all, they are US led sanctions. You know, dozens of countries came together with the US to impose those. So its success does not belong just to the US, and its possible failure also does not belong to the US. But I think that's the winning strategy. The minute you're isolating the US, then you're also isolating the dollar. So I do agree that multilateral is the best approach.
Okay. You just mentioned that the dollar's dominance is geopolitically related. To me, it's also linked to the size of our economy, the depth of our capital markets, good rule of law, and then kind of the, what I call the network and inertia effects. That is, it's already there, and if it ain't broke, why fix it? Is dollar dominance here to stay for the foreseeable future? And beyond weaponization, what do you see as the risks or key considerations?
I do think it's here to stay for the foreseeable future. The number one reason is that there's no alternative. I think that the discussions that have been going on these days about de-dollarization is always a healthy thing to talk about and for everyone to realize, particularly in the US and particularly policymakers, government officials, to realize that this is not something that you want to take for granted or be complacent about, and that protecting this national treasure is something that at times of our history is going to be an active duty. But if there's any threat, you know, people say, oh, well, the BRICS countries want to get together and create their own currency or a way to trade outside of the dollar. There's nothing wrong with a little bit of diversification away from the dollar. I don't think any foreign threat is as big of a threat as the domestic threats that we have. I think the dollar is king because with Bretton Woods in 1944, the world wanted a stable democracy, rule of law, independent agencies. At the time, the country had a much better fiscal outlook. Those are all the reasons it became king dollar. And we need to tend to those. So make sure we're maintaining our democracy, make sure we are trying to actually address our deficits. And it starts with unity and democracy. If the country's partisan divides continue as they are now, then there's no way that Congress can then get together and make the difficult decisions and spending cuts to bring down the deficit. If there's no rule of law, if we don't have free and fair elections, if we can't agree on the election results, if our agencies like the Fed do not maintain their independence, or even Supreme Court, right now public trust between Americans and the Supreme Court is at all-time low, and some of that might have to do with ethics scandals. So unless we can really come and look at the foundation of democracy and make sure it's strong, we are our own greatest threat.
I totally agree with that. And I think that's a good note to conclude on. You've emphasized that we need to keep our house in order, well manage our affairs, and be seen as a trustworthy actor at home and in the global arena. And if we're able to do that, the dollar will preserve its dominant role for the foreseeable future. But the benefits of such behavior are far greater than just in the realm of the dollar, beneficial to Americans and our futures. So, well, let us wrap up. You undoubtedly have a busy schedule, places to go. Thanks for joining me today, sharing your insights. And again, the book is entitled Paper Soldiers: How the Weaponization of the Dollar Changed the World Order. Thank you, Saleha.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of the OMFIF podcast. If you found today's conversation engaging, make sure to stay tuned for additional thought-provoking discussions on worldwide finance, economics, and policy by subscribing to our channel. Stay connected of the latest developments by following us on our LinkedIn page, OMFIF Economic and Monetary Policy Institute.